So now this Sunday, we are backing up a little bit from our previous study in Genesis by a chapter or two, because I want to revisit something we've actually talked about before. I did a special study of this section a couple of years ago, about a year or so ago, and I've actually changed my thinking on some aspects of this, and that's one reason I want to revisit this, but also because it's part of the sequential study. Now, this man Abraham has been called by God to leave his family and all of that and move toward Canaan, the promised land. He goes, his nephew Lot and his family goes with them. And in the course of things, I'm summarizing what's happening in the chapters and verses leading up to where we are. In the course of things, Abram winds up going into Egypt. And he does this because there's a famine in the area where he was, in Canaan. And so he goes into Egypt because there's food and he can have some influence there. And this is where we pick up in verses 10 through 20 of Genesis chapter 12 and the title, Things You Don't Expect. Let me start out by mentioning a 2004 study conducted by a visiting professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She conducted a very interesting survey. That professor specialized in studying forms of human deception. You know, they do that in universities nowadays. They specialize in some of the most absurd things. But at any rate, in the survey, she asked college students and members of the community at large to keep a notebook of the number of lies, the number of lies that they told in 1 week. Well, by the end of the experiment, the professor found that the students had lied to each other and other college students at least once, 38% of the people that they came in contact with. They lied at least once to 38% of the people they came in contact with. But in the community at large, outside the college, people lied to 30% of those with whom they interacted. And based on her research, she suggested that we all fall into one of two categories of liars. Some of us are self-centered liars. You know, we lie to make ourselves look good. And the rest are other centered liars. We lie in order to avoid hurting someone's feelings. And that experiment also found that the proverbial white lie was something most often told to strangers, people you don't know that well. I'm saying that because the verses that we have considered today, I might say we are reconsidering, according to some commentators, are an example of Abram being a deceptive liar. Now, we'll come to that soon enough. But for now, again, let me recap a little bit. Abram has gone to Egypt because, according to verse 10, there was a food shortage in the land. And so he arrives at his destination only to be met with a drought that made it impossible for him to remain there with his herds and flocks. And since he was not a property owner at that point, he had to move into Egypt. And for the moment, God's promise to him of having descendants and land and all this sort of thing did not appear to be, shall we say, very promising. But by faith, Abraham persevered and he moved his men and his livestock into Egypt. Now, as I mentioned a moment ago, what follows has led some expositors and preachers to condemn Abram as a deceptive liar. So in order to take a serious look at this, let's consider again what we read in verses 11 to 13. And it came to pass, and I'm reading from the New King James Version, and it came to pass when he was close to entering Egypt that he said to his wife Sarai, or Sarah, indeed I know that you are a woman of beautiful countenance, therefore it will happen when the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife, and they will kill me, but they will let you live. Please say you are my sister, that it may be well with you for me for your sake, that I may live because of you. Now, with that, I want you to consider the following five things. First of all, Abraham's comment to the Egyptians that they are comment about the Egyptians that they would kill him and capture his wife was absolutely true. It was not without foundation. It was a common thing in many of these types of cultures for the potentate, the king, whoever, to have a harem of women at his disposal, so to speak. But you see, in a family-centered culture, rape is considered a capital offense. It has an even wider consequence in many ways than murder. Rape can introduce what we would call an alien gene pool into the family. And in a family-centric culture, that is a most grievous offense. Murder takes a man's life. Rape or adultery can shatter his future and forever corrupt his family line. So that's the first thing. Why? There's some background to this that is not often seen or taken into consideration. Secondly, and I'm indebted to Dr. Russ Dooney for this observation. He says the nature of treason varies from culture to culture. Now, I've mentioned this from this pulpit before. You see, in a family-centered culture, a culture or society where family is the topmost important thing in the preservation of the life of the family, anything that threatens the stability of the family is considered treason. By contrast, in an ecclesiastically centered culture, such as the medieval culture of Europe and the Roman Catholic Church, heresy and blasphemy are considered treason. But the treason we're most familiar with is when you have a statist or governmental-centered culture, and that means that treason means giving aid and comfort to the enemy. And to quote Dr. Russ Dooney directly, he said, and listen to this carefully, please, like many of his observations, this is astoundingly accurate. He said, when a culture shifts or changes, so too does its definition of treason. Let that sink in. You know, he once said that if you want to know the foundation of law, or what the God is of any society, find out the foundation of the legal system. Because the defining of law is a divine prerogative. And when you see what culture relies on for a source of law, that will tell you what it believes is godlike. And here he's telling us this other great truth, that when a culture begins to change, especially if it's been family-centered or ecclesiastical-centered or government-centered, its definition of treason will change. Thirdly, in terms of how people describe their relations to those days, their relationships to each other, there's a sense in which Abram is not asking Sarah to lie, because she was, in fact, a close relative of his. I mean, they weren't brother and sister literally, but there was some distant kinship between them. Also, in the vocabulary of the day, close female relatives were often referred to as sisters. You know, in some cultures, even today, terms such as brother and cousin are used interchangeably. Have you ever seen any of those Chinese kung fu movies, you know, where they've got the subtitles or even just they're dubbed? You'll see that. And I'm not a Chinese linguist or anything like that, but I've noticed there are times when two guys in the movie who are not clearly, according to the storyline, blood related, you're brother so-and-so or cousin so-and-so. It's a literal translation from the terms in that language, and that's what it means. The term brother and cousin are used interchangeably. Fourthly, the looming question in this case is, what in the world was Abraham supposed to do? Yeah, I mean, the Hollywood movie version of this would have him bravely declare, "You will have to kill me first to get to my wife, Sarah." And, of course, the Egyptians would have killed him on the spot. And where would that have left her? Do you see, then, that this is not so easily dismissed as him being a gigantic liar? Abram was no fool. He knew that he was helpless. And frankly, friends, foolhardiness never gets the Lord's endorsement. And then fifthly, the obvious fact is, Yahweh delivered Abram and Sarah. And as we shall see later, he will also save Isaac, their son, in a similar situation. Now, to say it again, our modern commentators, some of them, are very quick to rebuke Abraham. But one person who does not rebuke him for his behavior here is Almighty God, is Yahweh. However, what he was afraid would happen did, in fact, happen. Sarah was seen by some Egyptian princes. They mentioned her beauty to the Pharaoh, and she was taken into his palace. Now, we need to put out on the table right now that that does not mean that she was immediately raped or sexually abused. See, in some ancient cultures, women taken into a harem went through a long process of physical and ritual purification. And we know that in some cases, there were girls and women who lived and died in harems without ever having been called on to render service, shall we say. In the meantime, Abram acquires considerable wealth. Notice, or listen again in chapter 12, 15, 16, I'm reading from the Christian Standard Bible. Pharaoh's official saw her and praised her to Pharaoh, so the woman was taken into Pharaoh's household, and he, that is Pharaoh, treated Abram well because of her, and Abram acquired flocks and herds and male and female donkeys and male and female slaves and camels. So as a result, the man's becoming wealthy, had become very wealthy. He was already wealthy. We knew that from him leaving, you know, Ur of the Chaldees and Haran. But now he's even more wealthy. But look again at verse 17. I'm reading this from the New Jerusalem Bible. But Yahweh inflicted severe plagues on Pharaoh and his household because of Abram's wife Sarai. Pharaoh somehow learned the cause of this bad fortune, so to speak, that was befalling him in these plagues, and at once sent for Abraham. So we have sort of an early distant warning about the events that we've already read about in the early chapters of Exodus and the 10 plagues that would become upon the Pharaoh's house in that incident. But he sends for Abraham, and Pharaoh accuses him of trickery in verses 18 to 20. I think what's noteworthy is that he asked for no return to any of the wealth that he'd given Abraham. He didn't ask for it back. And also, he warned his people against doing any harm to him. So the Egyptian ruler understood that had Abraham not done what he did, Abram would have been killed by Pharaoh's men. And that might have even led his family, the Pharaoh's family and his nation, to far greater catastrophes. I'm sure that Abram must have considered the realistic fact that what had been almost done to him had been done to many a man before Abram ever arrived on the scene in Egypt. In this case, however, God intervened and Pharaoh wanted no further judgment from God. Pharaoh realized that this man, Abram, was protected by divine power and not somebody to be interfered with. In that day, Egypt was what we would think of in terms today as a superpower. Vast armies, military might. Nonetheless, Egyptian culture, from what we know, again, at this stage of its culture, was still family-centric to some degree. They still held the Egyptian family in high regard. And it was not to be willingly disrupted or interfered with, family life. Egypt had moved more quickly than other countries from being family-centered, however, to government-centered. In other words, they would become and were becoming statist, man-centered, state worship. It was, however, still sensitive to the importance of the family. And again, to quote Dr. Rastuni, he says, some fine scholars have resorted to abusive language in describing Abram, one man even calling him base and despicable. But friends, as I've tried to help us see, in reality, Abraham had more sense and more faith in God than many of his modern critics. And here is a key point that we need to learn and not forget. God's people do not owe the truth to men who seek to do evil. No, yes, indeed, before you get all panicky, yes, indeed, in a court of law, we are required to bear witness to the truth. And in that situation, regardless of the circumstance, we must pray for God's justice to be done as we're called upon to tell the truth. But when we are confronted by evil people, we owe them nothing. Because those kinds of people are only interested in our speaking truthfully if it helps them advance their evil plans. And so the unanticipated result of this episode in Abram's life is that he was made even wealthier than he was before, as I said. He's given sheep and oxen and donkeys and men servants and maid servants and camels. Just to list the items again. And again, he was a wealthy man before he went there. Now he's extremely wealthy. But friends, this led to something, or would lead to something, that he did not expect. He did not anticipate. And although he dodged a bullet, so to speak, in terms of preserving his family, there was another challenge awaiting him. With this newly acquired riches, there was no longer room enough for his sheep and Lot's sheep and herds to gather. This, you remember, this is his nephew. And so, look, I'm going to read into chapter 13 for you to get the context of this. Because this is a thing he didn't expect, one of them. So, I'm reading from the ESV, chapter 13, beginning at verse 1 and then going through verse 11. So, Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him, into the Negev, another area in between Egypt and the Promised Land. Now, Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver and in gold. And he journeyed on from the Negev as far as Bethel to the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai, to the place where he'd made an altar at the first, and there Abram called upon the name of Yahweh. And Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents, so that the land could not support both of them dwelling together. For their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together, and there was strife between the herdsmen of Abraham's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. And at the time, the Canaanites and the Perizzites were also dwelling in the land. And then Abram said to Lot, "Let there be no strife between you and me, and between your herdsmen and my herdsmen, for we are kinsmen. Is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself from me. If you take the left hand, I'll take the right. If you go to the right side, I'll go to the left." And Lot lifted up his eyes, and he saw the Jordan Valley was well watered, irrigated, in other words, everywhere, like the garden of the Lord. Notice, like the land of Egypt in the direction of Zoar. This is where Yahweh destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Verse 11, so Lot chose for himself all the Jordan Valley, and Lot journeyed east, and thus they separated from each other. So Abraham told Lot to choose where he wanted to pitch his tent and take his flock, and he would go the opposite direction. And when Lot chose Sodom and Gomorrah, he chose it based on how it looked. Let me read verse 10 again from chapter 13 in a different translation. Then Lot looked in the direction of Zoar, and as he could see, he saw that the whole Jordan plain was well watered like the Lord's garden or like Egypt. This is before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. You notice this. Lot chose Sodom and Gomorrah because to him it looked like the land of Egypt. If Abraham had never gone to Egypt, Lot would have never known what the land of Egypt looked like. So that was something not expected, that these guys were going to have to separate the way they did and that he would make this fateful choice, I mean F-A-T-E, fateful choice, to move to Sodom and Gomorrah without knowing or caring, perhaps, where that was going to lead. But we know where it led, and we'll be reading about it. But there's something else looming on the horizon here. Something else unanticipated. Something else not expected. Pharaoh gave Abraham not only livestock, but as I've read twice now, he gave him slaves, men servant and maid servants. One of those maid servants, one of those handmaids, was a woman named Hagar. And we will see soon enough the unanticipated, unexpected chaos that arose from that particular fact. Let us pray.